than my father. We were but children then, but we became..." She paused dramatically and slid a warm look to Hart. "Quite close. Did we not, darling?" "So this is who you've been running off to." The woman's mouth went tight, to Esta's immense satisfaction. Hart Darrigan, for once, seemed at a loss for words. "He left to continue his studies, but now we are reunited," Esta told the woman, sidling up to Hart and slipping her arm through his in a proprietary way. He started to pull away, but she held him tight. "And you are?" "Evelyn Demure," the woman said, making an obvious show of looking Esta over from head to toe. As she did so, Esta felt the warm energy of Evelyn's magic wrap around her, and she had the sudden feeling of being drawn to her, the sudden desire to release Hart. She couldn't seem to stop her arms from falling away.
"Evelyn,"
Hart warned. A moment later, the warmth faded, but Esta had already released her hold on his arm.
"Is there something you needed?"
Frustration simmered in his voice. Evelyn gave Esta a smile that was mostly teeth before she turned to Hart.
"A letter was delivered for you just now,"
she said, holding out a crumpled envelope.
"Next time, get someone else to take your messages, would you? I'm not your errand boy."
"No one could confuse you for a boy, Evelyn,"
he said, with a grin obviously meant to charm, but the woman didn't soften. His smile faltered as he took the letter from her outstretched hand. He tore the edge of the envelope, but even once he pulled out the folded sheet of paper, Evelyn didn't seem in any hurry to leave.
"I thought you weren't allowing visitors backstage anymore,"
she said, glancing again at Esta with a look as sharp as one of Viola's knives. Hart didn't seem to hear her. He was too busy reading the note, his brows furrowing over narrowed eyes. Then, all at once, he balled the paper in his closed fist, and when he looked up, the fury in his eyes had Esta wanting to take a step back.
"Usually I wouldn't,"
he said, looking at her with a stony, unreadable expression.
"But for an old friend, I had to make an exception."
Everything in her went on alert. Esta had no idea what was in that note, but something had changed in him. All playfulness was gone. She didn't know what this new game was, and she had a feeling that she shouldn't stick around to find out.
"I was actually about to leave," she told Evelyn. "It was lovely to see you again, Hart. Do think about my proposition."
He stared at her, his mouth tight. "Perhaps we could discuss it in more detail," he said flatly.
"Soon."
It was a victory, but she couldn't help feeling like there was something else happening that she didn't understand and wasn't in control of.
"Tomorrow, perhaps?"
she asked, hopeful and wary all at once.
"We could continue our discussion?"
His gray eyes bored into her.
"I'm not sure about tomorrow. I've got some things to clear up. It might take a few days,"
he told her. His voice carried a curious note of determination.
"I'll look forward to it,"
she told him, trying not to show her unease. Then she pasted on a smile.
"Until then, it was lovely to meet you,"
she told Evelyn, before turning to take her leave. Just as she was opening the door, he grabbed her wrist and tugged her back toward him.
"That isn't any way for old friends to part, now is it?"
he asked softly, almost playfully, but the look on his face didn't match his tone. He was already pulling her toward him.
"As you said, we were once so very close."
She had to force herself not to pull away. Esta needed Evelyn, who was still watching with ice in her eyes, to believe that she was who she claimed to be. Within the hour, the entire theater would know about the curious visitor in Hart Darrigan's dressing room. You couldn't buy gossip as effective as that. He'd be stuck with her. But before she could find a way out of his grasp, she was in his arms. All at once, she was back in the Haymarket. His eyes held no warmth or seduction, but her stomach flipped just the same at the intensity she saw there.
It gave her a moment to pull away, to refuse him, and what she knew was about to happen. But pulling away would mean destroying the cover she was trying to establish. Instead, she looked up at him, met the challenge head on, dared him to go through with it. It's an act, she told herself. When amusement sparked behind those gray eyes of his, when they softened just a little, Professor Lachlan had warned her about the magician. Don't be taken in by him. Get the book before he does, and stop the... Then, his lips were on hers, and she felt the warm energy of his affinity wrap around her, sink into her skin, violating the boundaries between them in a way she didn't have time to prepare herself for and couldn't protect herself from. His energy was hot, electric, and there was something about it that pulled her in, even as she knew that it was a trap. Despite the heat of his magic, the kiss itself held no passion or warmth. It was over before it had barely begun, but something had happened. He'd gained something more than her embarrassment.
Until later, then, sweetheart,
he murmured as he released her. His expression was impassive, even as his eyes glittered with victory.
I'll look forward to it, she said,
and was glad to hear that her voice trembled only the tiniest bit. It wasn't fear, but fury that jangled through her. Fury at him for laying a hand on her. Fury at herself for not being ready. Then she let herself out of the dressing room and pulled time around her so that she could get out of the theater without anyone seeing her shake. The message. Hart stared at the open door, trying to figure out what he'd just heard and seen. The wild thoughts and images twisting through the girl's mind didn't make any sense at all.
Well,
Evelyn drawled, her rouged lips pursed.
That was instructional.
Yeah,
he said, more to himself than her.
It was.
And yet he couldn't help but think he knew even less now than before.
You two are old friends.
She gave an indelicate snort.
And I'm the Virgin Mary.
Her words shook him from his thoughts, and he finally realized Evelyn was still watching him. Her bright hair and painted face looked tired and garish in the dim light of his dressing room lamp. It wasn't only the shadows that it cast over her face that made her seem older, a worn-out shell of who she might have once been. It was that he was looking at her now compared to the girl, to Esta, and seeing their intrinsic difference. The kiss had left him with more questions than answers, and it had shaken him in a way he couldn't think too closely about. From the way she ran out of there, he had a feeling that it had shaken her, too. Rightly so, he supposed. After all, when he took her off guard and pushed past her defenses, he'd sensed that while the girl might have come with a message from Dolph, she'd also come for herself.
So the note. Was it important, or what?
Evelyn asked, nodding toward it.
Just something I have to take care of, he told her. He tucked the crumpled paper into his pocket and grabbed his jacket.
I have somewhere I need to be.
He left Evelyn in his dressing room and headed out with the sinking feeling that he might already be too late. The paper had been monogrammed with the familiar symbol of the Five-Point Gang, a cross with an extra arm that mirrored the legendary intersection of Orange Street, Cross Street, and Anthony Street, which was now the turf of Paul Kelly. It was the same symbol they'd branded into the skin on his shoulder when he'd made the choice to take Kelly's offer. Seeing it would have been enough to set him on edge. But the address, written in a strong, slanting hand, Kelly's own, was only a block from the apartment he'd rented for his mother last May. He knew at once the note was a warning about how much Paul Kelly could still control Hart's future. Certain it would be pointless to go to his mother's apartment, he went off in search of the address and the message instead. The toffs who went slumming south of Houston might have thought that Chinatown was where the opium dens in the city were, but in reality, joints were hidden all over town. Knowing his mother, it wasn't a surprise that the address on the paper led to one of the worst he'd ever seen. When he found her on a low platform in a dingy basement on Broome Street, He was already too late. She was barely conscious. Her head supported awkwardly by a small wooden stool, and her hand loosely clutching the long pipe. Scattered on the floor nearby were three shells, their curved bowls containing the dark evidence of her latest binge. He had his suspicions about how she'd obtained so much of the sickly sweet drug, but he didn't really want to know. It was bad enough that he had to see her like this, and to realize he still cared enough to be disappointed. Still, even as her cracked lips moved in some silent conversation within her drug-induced dream, she was alive and mostly safe.
Whatever she'd done to him, what he'd driven her to do, pieces of the woman he'd once known remained beneath the years of disappointment and madness.
Part of her would always be the fairy-like creature who had spun tales of a distant land for the small boy he'd once been. It was his own fault she'd chosen to leave him. His own fault for driving her away. Her hair was gray now, and he couldn't stop himself from cringing as he pushed the greasy strands away from her face. "Ma," he said gently, trying to rouse her.
"Come on. It's time to go."
She opened her drowsy eyes. Her light irises were glassy, her pupils large and vacant-looking from the effects of the drug, but she smiled at him before her eyes drifted shut again.
"No, Ma," he told her through gritted teeth. "You have to wake up. We have to go."
He had to get her out of there. He needed to get her somewhere safe before Kelly or his men found her again. Or before she ran up an even bigger bill he would end up paying. A soft moan gurgled from her throat in response, but her face remained slack, her breath shallow. Then she opened her eyes again, and for a moment they focused on him.
"No,"
she whispered.
"Please, no."
"I'm not going to hurt you, Ma,"
he said, pulling his hand back from her.
"Leave me alone,"
she told him, her voice ragged with fear and disgust.
"Unnatural boy. You made him go. You took him from me."
"I know,"
he said tightly, because it was easier to agree than to argue.
"It's all my fault."
Which was the only truth that mattered anymore. He'd only been a boy. He hadn't known what he was capable of or how to control what he could do. When she'd found out he'd made his father, a drunk who'd rather use his hands to beat them than to make a living, leave, his mother had turned on him. She'd risked everything to try crossing the brink to find his father. She didn't get through it, though. Even her desperation to find the man she loved wasn't enough to push her past the terrible boundary. But she'd tried. She'd touched its power, and it had certainly changed her. There were days Hart wondered if death wouldn't have been a kinder fate. When he found her again years later, she wasn't the woman she'd once been. Instead, she spent her days chasing anything that would take away the ache of the emptiness the Brink and his lout of a father had left behind. Maybe Hart should have hated her for abandoning him. Maybe there was a small part of him that did. But in the end, he reserved his true hatred for the father who had deserted them long before he'd actually left. And for himself, for driving her away. She raised her hands slowly and gazed at them with unfocused eyes, as if noticing them for the first time.
"These used to work miracles. The women used to come to me even when I was a girl,"
she said, her voice still carrying the soft notes of his childhood. Then her expression turned sour.
"But you took it from me."
His jaw tensed.
"You can blame me later. Right now we need to get you home."
She looked up at him, her pale green eyes lost in her own memories.
"Little Molly O'Doherty can make you pretty enough to win any man, they'd say. I can't anymore, and it hurts."
Her voice broke, and she closed her eyes again.
"It aches so terribly, and I wanted it to stop, if only for a little while. I needed—"
"You don't have to explain it to me,"
he told her, his throat tight with regret and shame for what she'd become, what he'd pushed her to.
"Can you get up?"
He didn't want to have to touch her again. The rank sweat, or worse, was overpowering enough from where he was. It reminded him too much of what her leaving had cost him, of nights spent in trash heaps trying to get warm, the stink of unwashed bodies that had hunted him, because they could, because no one had been there to stop them. Because deep down, he had known he deserved it all. He cursed when his mother wouldn't move, and wondered if maybe he could pay the man at the door to keep her until the drug wore off. He could collect her then, or maybe send someone else for her. He needed to go. He'd moderated his breathing, but he was still starting to feel the haze of the poppy's smoke wrap around him, leaching out the frantic energy that the girl and Kelly's note had left him with. And he hated it. Hated the way it dulled who and what he was. Hated the way that part of him wanted to stay for a while and allow the quiet emptiness to fill him up. Just for a little while.
"I'm going now, Ma,"
he said, shaking off the temptation.
"I'll be back in the morning when you're feeling better."
Standing to leave, he looked at her one last time, hating her and loving her just the same. She was yet another thing tying him to the city, his duty to her like a straitjacket holding him against his will, a locked box he couldn't find his way out of. He was barely out the door when he heard frantic shouts and realized that a crowd had gathered down the block, the smell of wood smoke and something else, something harsher and more chemical, hung in the air, and he saw that buildings nearby were on fire. On either end of the block, the blaze raged toward the center, toward the building where his mother was. It couldn't have been an accident. Two buildings burning like that. Two buildings bookending the room where his mother lay half unconscious, not with the note he had still crumpled in his pocket. The note, it seemed, wasn't the only message Paul Kelly had sent him. Cursing the whole way, he ran back down the short flight of steps into the basement den, shouting for the sleepy-eyed guard to rouse the others. He grabbed his mother, his stomach turning and his throat tightening as the stink of her unwashed hair and clothes assaulted him. The smoke-filled night would be a reprieve compared to what she smelled of, but he pushed through his revulsion and got her out of the building, through the crowd, and into the waiting taxi at the curb. He gave the driver her address and tried to keep her upright as the carriage rattled to a start across the uneven pavers. When he leaned out the window, away from the smell of her, he saw Paul Kelly's men watching him from the shadows. The center won't hold. Bella Strega. Usually the noise of the crowded barroom was enough to settle Dolph's nerves on even the most frustrating of days. He always sat against the back wall, in part because he only had to watch one direction for an attack, and in part because he could watch the events of the night without being involved in them. From his usual table, he could observe everything he'd built, test the mood of the Bowery, and plan for all he still wanted to accomplish without anyone bothering him. Though the room was already nearly filled with people drinking and laughing, Dolph found himself restless. There had been reports of a fire down on Broom Street. He'd sent some of his people to help stop the flames and get the innocent out, but there was only so much they could do without alerting suspicion. People would be hurt, and he was impotent to do anything about it. Tilly had gone out on some errand, or he would have been in her kitchen, allowing her easy way to soothe him. He needed some of her soup. Its heady, golden broth laden with matzo balls, or some of her fresh bread that tasted like life itself. He needed the book, but to get the book, he needed Hart Derrigan's help. The girl wasn't his last chance to hook Hart Derrigan. He knew that. But she was close to it, and she'd been gone a long time. It rankled, still not knowing what she was capable of. A thief, for certain. Most likely trustworthy, based on her performance at the museum. But she was still hiding something from him, and since he didn't know how her affinity worked, he couldn't predict how she might move against him. And he couldn't ask, not without revealing his own lost affinity. His crew expected him to already know. Not that long ago, he wouldn't have worried at all. Lena, with her calm strength, would have been able to neutralize the girl if she attacked with her magic. and before the brink he would have been ready, would have known the flavor of that magic from the moment they'd met. Before the brink, he would have been able to do so much more. With a shake of her hand, he could have used her affinity for himself for a time, without harming her, just as he could with any magus. Once, his talent had made him seem limitless. Now he had to settle for pretending, for running a long con on those who trusted him. He wasn't so green as to think that the game would last forever. Someone would eventually realize his weakness and take advantage of it. The only question was who and when the betrayal would come. As though spurred on by his dark thoughts, a commotion erupted from the front of the building. He went on alert, ready for the danger, as the double doors of the barroom sailed open, clanging against the wall from the force. The crowd turned almost as one to see who had arrived, and then murmuring began, sweeping through the saloon like the fires that often tore through the Bowery's most dilapidated tenements, like the one earlier that night had. Dolph was nearly halfway across the room when he saw it wasn't any danger at all, but John Yu standing in the open doorway. The look of distress on the boy's face had Dolph's neck prickling in alarm, but he moved faster when he saw who John Yu carried.
"We're closed," Dolph shouted. "Viola, shut it down. Mooch, Sean, get everyone out of here."
His crew was well trained. They didn't ask questions or hesitate, but snapped into motion like a well-oiled machine. His employees were already gently guiding the other patrons toward the exit, but everyone was craning their necks to see what had caused the confusion.
"He's killing her!"
someone shouted. And Dolph felt the anger and fear of the crowd turn almost as a single unit toward John Yu. Their once unsettled murmurs grew into an angry, noisy jumble of languages. Energy spiked throughout the room as each person drew their affinity around them. Whether for protection or to attack, Dolph didn't know. A moment later, the first slur tore through the room, its guttural sound as vicious and ugly as the hatred behind the word. Then the tenor of the crowd changed, transforming into something more dangerous. Dolph raised his cane and brought its silver cap down with a vicious crack against the last call bell with an ear-splitting clang.
"I said we're closed. Out, all of you."
He took a step forward, swinging his cane in front of him and not caring who it hit, as he helped to herd the crowd out into the night.
"Push those out of the way,"
Dolph called, pointing to a pair of shorter, square tables that lined the wall as he latched the door.
"Put her over there on the floor where she won't hurt herself."
What happened on Fulton Street? John Yu carried Tilly, writhing and moaning in his arms toward the spot that had been cleared for them. Around him, Dolph's people drew closer. He could feel their wariness, their distrust. Before he could settle her, Viola pushed her way to the front, wiping her hands on her apron.
"Che cose?"
she started to say, but the words died on her tongue when she saw who he had, and she went dangerously still.
"What did you do to her?"
Viola growled. John Yu felt her magic before she had even drawn her knives. Hot, angry, it assaulted him like a blast from a furnace, and the pain that gripped his entire body had him gasping for breath. His blood felt like a fire, his lungs like dried cement. He struggled to stay upright, to keep from dropping Tilly, whose writhing made her difficult to hold.
"Viola, enough!"
Dolph barked, catching him by the elbow before he toppled over.
"Unless you want him to drop her, leave him be. Someone get Nibs in here now."
Viola's eyes were sharp and bright, but a moment later the heat receded from his blood, and John Yu drew in a deep, heaving breath. Suddenly aware of the grip Dolph had on his arm, he pulled away and took the final few steps of his own to settle Tilly on the floor.
"Hold her legs for me, Vi,"
Dolph directed, as he took hold of Tilly's upper arms to keep her from scratching at her face and neck. Already the skin there was red with raised welts from her own nails. She was still thrashing about as she moaned in agony, but her color had all but drained on the long walk back. She looked deathly pale.
"What happened?"
Dolph demanded, his expression cold. John Yu went on alert at the suspicion in Dolph's voice. He'd been stupid to let his guard down, to believe that he could make a life for himself away from his own people, to believe that he could be accepted outside the streets of Chinatown, when he was barely accepted within their boundaries. Of course, he'd heard the same slurs hurled at him before, and at others on the streets of the city. He should have been used to it. But the surprise at hearing it here, in the place he thought of now as his home, to be accused of killing the girl he was trying to save, it shouldn't have been any more than he expected. But then Viola turned on him as well, and now Dolph was looking at him with ice in his pale eyes. He expected at any moment to feel the burn of the tattoo on his back, but to his surprise and relief it never came, which meant Dolph must trust him still. The knowledge was enough to unclog his throat and allow the words to break free, but he wasn't sure it was enough to heal the rift he felt in the room.
"I cannot say for sure."
"Try," Dolph commanded, his temper flaring. "What was she doing near the brink?"
"She wasn't at the brink,"
John Yu told him.
"This happened on Fulton Street."
Something new. By the time Esta made it back to the Bowery, the shock of whatever Hart Darrigan had done when he kissed her had mostly faded. But she didn't feel any better about her situation. On the streetcar ride downtown, she couldn't help herself from checking the clipping. It still hadn't changed back. Whatever success she'd had with Hart Darrigan, it hadn't been enough. She wasn't sure what would be enough. She carried that worry with her back to the Bowery, and the moment she stepped into the Strega, it swelled. Something was very, very wrong. It was late. Well into the time when the bar should have been packed with throngs of mages drinking away their sorrows and stress. But the saloon was nearly empty.
"We're closed,"
one of the bowler hat boys grunted, standing to block her way. His name was Sam or Sean, something with an S, but she was new enough that he didn't recognize her. Luckily, before she had to really argue her point, Nibs came and waved her in.
"What's going on?"
she asked, taking in the small crowd at the back of the room. The energy in the air was hot, erratic. Even from across the barroom, she sensed that everyone was on the edge of using whatever magic they had, and their fear snaked through the space like a living thing.
"Dolph shut us down about an hour ago,"
Nibs said, his expression more uncertain than she'd ever seen him.
"It's Tilly."
When Nibs finally pushed them through the gathered crowd, she saw Dolph talking in low tones to John Yu, while Viola held Tilly's legs to the ground to keep her from thrashing about. The mouse-haired girl was writhing like she was on fire. Her eyes were wide, staring at the ceiling, and her throat and face were red from where it looked like she'd raked her own nails down her skin.
"What happened to her?"
Esta asked, watching as Tilly grimaced, moaning and trying desperately to get free.
"We don't know,"
Nibs told her.
"Bring me some night wine," Dolph told John Yu. "Double the poppy."
John Yu looked grim as he nodded. He pushed his way past the group and returned a few minutes later with a bottle of inky liquid. Dolph told a few others to help Viola hold Tilly, and then, kneeling over her, he coaxed the liquor down her throat himself. Tilly took one halting sip at a time, choking on the liquid at first, and then gulping it desperately. Little by little, the writhing stopped, and Tilly's arms went limp at her sides, her eyes glassy and vacant. Dolph waited to make sure Tilly was calm before pulling himself stiffly to his feet. His skin was flushed, and a sheen of perspiration glistened on his upper lip as he ran a hand through his wavy hair.
"Take her upstairs,"
Dolph told a pair of the bowler-hatted boys, one of whom scooped the girl up into his arms.
"Go on and be with her,"
he said to Viola as he handed her the bottle of night wine.
"Let me know if there's any change."
Nibs spoke to Esta in a hushed tone, as if he didn't want anyone else to hear.
"Dolph thought it was the brink, but John Yu said it happened down on Fulton Street, near the deadline."
"What was she doing on Fulton Street?"
Esta asked.
"Trying to help someone,"
Dolph said, approaching them.
"Golda's son, Yosef. You remember her?"
he asked Esta.
"We visited their home just the other day. He was with a group of boys. They were playing some game, daring each other to go farther downtown, when something went wrong. One came back here for help. Everyone else was out dealing with a fire over on Broom Street, so Tilly went. Found John Yu on the way.
"I felt the cold energy in the air, warning us away," John Yu told them. But she insisted on helping the child. She'd barely reached for him when she went straight as a rod and fell backward.
He closed his eyes for a moment, as if remembering what he'd seen. Then she began shaking and moaning, as though being flayed by a thousand whips.
She could not hear me when I called to her, so I pulled her back, away from the boy's fallen body. I brought her back here.
"What about the boy?" Nibs asked.
I could not carry both, and I could not risk being struck down if I wanted to get her back safely. She was still breathing, and I thought maybe...
"You did fine," Dolph told him, clapping John Yu on the shoulder. "You could have left her. Plenty would have. I'm grateful you brought her back, and I'm grateful you came back to us as well."
John Yu's cheeks flushed, but he didn't look as though he agreed. From his wary, unsure expression, it was clear he thought he had failed in some way. Dolph didn't seem to notice.
"We'll need to send someone down to check and see if the boy's still there," Dolph said to Nibs. "If he is, I don't want anyone getting close enough to end up like Tilly. John Yu said it felt like the brink, so until we know more, that's how we'll treat it. Be sure to take someone who won't be at risk with you."
"What about his mother, Golda?" Nibs asked.
"I'll go tell her myself."
Nibs frowned. "You don't think it could be the entire deadline?" he asked John Yu.
"I don't know," John Yu said. "We better hope it's not," Dolph said. "It would cut the city in half. Still, something as big as this. Someone has to know something."
Dolph glanced at John Yu.
"I need information. Someone will have talked."
John Yu gave a serious nod.
"I'll go myself," he said.
"Do that," Dolph murmured.
After John Yu bowed slightly and headed out into the night, Dolph turned his attention to Nibs.
"After you take care of the boy, people need to be warned. We'll need to be vigilant, at least until we figure out what's causing this."
"I'm on it," Nibs said, and hurried off in the direction of the Bowery, taking a group of the bowler hat boys with him. Dolph waited until they were gone before he looked to Esta.
"Well?"
he asked, dispensing with any pleasantries. She knew what he was asking.
"I think he'll talk,"
she told him, wishing that alone was enough to fix the future, to save Dolph from that fate. "He said he had something to take care of, but he should send word to you soon."
"What else?"
he asked, eyeing her as though he knew there was more. She hesitated.
"He won't take your mark."
When Dolph was silent, she continued. "I told him it was negotiable." Dolph's expression creased.
"That wasn't for you to say."
"I didn't have much choice if I wanted to keep him interested. Maybe if you'd warned me, or if I even knew what the mark was, I could have come up with something else."
She leveled a frustrated glare in his direction, ignoring the danger he posed.
"He's willing to talk now. From what I understand, that's more than anyone else has managed to get from him."
Dolph glared back at her, but he didn't argue any further. After a long, tense moment, he turned to glance back at the door where they'd taken Tilly up to the apartments above. It stood empty and silent.
"How bad is it?"
Esta asked, but Dolph didn't have to answer for her to know the truth. She could see it in his anguished expression, in the tightness of his posture.
"For Tilly, it's as bad as it can be," he said. "For the rest of us, it's something new, and that rarely bodes well for our kind."
The Weight of Night. Dolph waited until the Strega was completely clear before he locked the doors and ventured out to discover what he could. Pulling his cloak around him and the brim of his cap low over his face, he headed south, toward Fulton Street and the notorious deadline. When the lights of the Bowery grew dim and the streets grew darker still, he switched the patch over his eye so that he could navigate the night without falling into a coal cellar or some other trap laid for unsuspecting marks. Rats rustled in the gutters as he passed, and the wind cut through his heavy cloak, but the cold March winds barely touched him. How could they? When everyone already said ice ran in his veins. Let them say it, he thought bitterly. Ice or no, his ways had saved enough that he wouldn't apologize for them. He'd carved out a life for himself, hadn't he? He'd battled against all odds to achieve what he had. His own family had seen him as a liability, had tossed him out when he couldn't work anymore at the factory that had mangled him as a child. To them, he was another mouth they couldn't feed. So they had sent him away to save the others. He couldn't blame them, really. Desperation and fear could make anyone do nearly anything, and sometimes a single sacrifice was necessary to save many. Back then, Dolph had been so angry, full of vinegar and bile. He'd been too stubborn to accept death, or the boys' workhouse as his life, lame foot or not. And he'd been too smart to follow anyone else. While the other urchins begged for bread or stole coins from fat pockets, the secrets Dolph stole helped to make him who he was. Those secrets would either save him or kill him in the end. Let the others fight over ragged strips of land they could never own. He knew the truth. There was a whole land made for him and his kind. Or there would be soon, if he had anything to do with it. Once the Brink came down, the mages could be free to do whatever they would. Once the old magic was restored, no one would be able to stop them. Without the Order of Ortis Aurea holding them back, they could remake the whole country as a land for magic. Those without it could learn for themselves what it was to live narrow, hen-scratched lives. They were close now, closer than he'd ever been. Soon he would have Darrigan, and then he would have Jack Grew, and then the Order would be in his sights. But first he needed to deal with this new danger that had risen up in their midst. He walked on, not bothered by any of the shadowy figures who huddled in doorways, their cigarettes flickering like fireflies in the bitter night air. Before he was within a block of Fulton Street, Dolph could already sense something wasn't right. There was a cold energy, sizzling in the air like a live current, a warning to any with magic to stay away. He pushed on, closer still, until he could force himself to go no farther. At the corner of Fulton and Nassau, he turned east and followed the icy energy along the length of Fulton. It felt almost as though he were walking along the perimeter of a high-voltage fence that was invisible to the eye, like the deadline had come to life. Dolph continued to walk, feeling his way along the line as it ran down Fulton. As he walked, he fought the strangest urge to reach out and run his fingers through the energy beyond the sidewalk's edge, to stir its power. Maybe it was some new trap, or maybe it was because he'd been touched already by the Brink, that its power was now a part of him. Magic was like that, whether natural, like that of the Magus, or corrupted, like the power the Order was able to wield. Like called to like. Magic, whatever its form, could tempt the weak with its promise of power, which was part of what the Sundren were afraid of, that magic was a drug, like the opium that trapped so many. Those without an affinity for it feared that magic was a compulsion. Those who had touched power knew it wasn't a completely unfounded fear. In the old countries, there were stories of magic, and magus run rampant. Plagues and deaths blamed on the same people who had once been asked to heal and guide. But that was before the disenchantment. Before the Ortis Aurea and other Sundren like them began hunting his kind and penning them in, destroying even the memory of a world permeated by the old magic, as they took power for themselves. The Order believed themselves to be men of reason. They called themselves enlightened, but in the end they were merely human, wanting what they didn't have and taking what wasn't theirs, because they could. This new danger was definitely man-made. Unnatural. The power it radiated felt broken, as though a part of the world had become unmoored from itself. Whatever had happened to the deadline, like the Brink, it had been designed to control. To punish. He had no idea how this new threat worked. He wasn't sure if it was simply a line or if its power had engulfed the entire southern end of Manhattan. And he wasn't sure if it was like the Brink, which would allow entry into the city but not escape, or if it would destroy any who crossed in either direction. But if this new line was the Brink,
if it marked a constriction of their territory, who was to say it wouldn't move again? If it continued to creep north, they would have nowhere to go. Across the street, John Yu materialized out of the night and began to walk toward him.
What news did you find?
John Yu shook his head.
No one's talking.
Coffer Hall is dark. If this is the Order's doing, they are very quiet.
It couldn't be anything but the Order's doing, Dolph argued.
Things are changing, and I can't say they're changing for the better.
He glanced over to John Yu, read the stiffness in the boy's spine, the closed expression on his face.
About earlier. I'm sorry for what Viola did.
John Yu's expression didn't change. She was afraid. People do all manner of things when fear drives their hearts.
Still, you're one of us, and I don't want you to ever doubt that. The people in the bar, the things they said earlier, they don't speak for me, and they won't be allowed to darken my doorway again.
John Yu inclined his head, but he didn't respond, and Dolph couldn't tell if he believed the sincerity of his apology or not. Dolph couldn't blame him. After all John Yu had been through, after all the city and the country had done to his people, why would he trust anyone, much less Dolph, who made it his business to remain as mysterious and unknowable as he could?
You'll keep looking?
Dolph asked.
For Tilly?
He added, knowing that whatever John Yu might think of him, he would do what he could for the girl.
Of course,
he said, and with another small bow, he disappeared into the night. The weight of the night on his shoulders, Dolph turned back toward the Bowery, back toward Golda's apartment and the empty place at her table, back to his streets, his own home, and all the people he was no longer sure he could protect. A room filled with fear. As the sky started to lighten outside Viola's window, Esther rubbed her eyes and stretched out the kinks in her back. She had finally convinced Viola to give Tilly more night wine a few hours before dawn. The first person who had offered her kindness in this city was now slumped on her side in the bed, her thin shift damp with sweat, her eyes glassy and unfocused. She looked 3 feet from death's doorstep. But at least she wasn't screaming anymore. Esta dipped the rag back into the bucket of murky water and placed it against Tilly's feverish forehead once again. At the feel of the cool cloth, Tilly moaned. Viola paused until Tilly settled again, but then continued to pace in the corner of the small room.
You can sit down any time now,
Esta told her. So much for the cold, fearless assassin. Viola had been wearing a hole in the floor for most of the night.
I still don't like it. Tilly, she never had the night wine. She would have hated to be like this,
Viola said, her voice trembling as she gestured vaguely toward the girl in the bed.
She wasn't exactly having the time of her life with all the screaming and moaning,
Esta muttered. If she thought Viola would accept sympathy, Esta would have offered it. Instead, she gave Viola something to strike back at, a distraction from her worry.
What did you say?
Viola demanded.
Nothing. Never mind.
Esta dipped the rag and placed it against Tilly's feverish brow again. Neither of them spoke for a long while, but Viola's fear filled the room as she resumed her pacing.
Does she know how you feel?
Esta asked softly, not looking at Viola. Viola's footsteps went still, and a long, uncomfortable moment passed, during which Esta wondered if she'd gone too far. But then...
No.
Viola said, her voice barely a breath, but containing more heartbreak than a single word should be able to hold. Esta met Viola's eyes.
You never told her?
Viola let out a ragged breath and looked at the bed where Tilly lay. She shook her head.
It doesn't matter. Her friendship is enough.
Esta took the cloth and dipped it back into the water, not knowing what to say, what comfort to offer. She didn't know if Tilly had known or understood how Viola felt, but from the warm smiles she'd seen the two share, Esta couldn't help but think that maybe she did. And Esta knew Tilly cared for Viola, even if it wasn't in quite the same way. Still, she wasn't sure whether saying anything would help Viola or make things worse, so she kept her thoughts to herself. But she stayed.
The morning passed slowly into afternoon, the streets outside the window growing noisy with the business of the day, but nothing inside the room had changed. Tilly had not improved. If anything, she seemed to be more pale, and her cries more desperate every time the night wine began to wear off. Tilly's cries had Viola strung tight as a garrote wire, and when Viola's temper snapped each time they had to give Tilly more night wine, Esta's was the only exposed throat in the room, which would have been an easier burden to shoulder if Esta wasn't aware of just how deadly Viola could be. By the afternoon, Esta's shoulders were tight, and her eyes felt like someone had thrown sand into them from the lack of sleep. She couldn't remember the last time she'd eaten, and as much as she wanted to help Tilly, she wished someone, anyone, would come and relieve her. As if in answer, the door to the room opened, its uneven hinges creaking, and Dolph Saunders limped into the room. His hair was a riot of waves around his face, and his eyes were ringed with dark circles. When she saw him, Viola stepped forward, putting herself between Dolph and Tilly.
"Stand down, Vi. I'm not here for that,"
Dolph told her, sounding tired and drawn.
"And despite your impressive skills, you know well enough that you couldn't stop me if I were."
Viola's jaw clenched, but she didn't argue. Dolph turned to Esta.
"Have you slept any?"
he asked, his voice gruff. "About as much as you did, from the looks of it," Esta told him.
"You've been here all day?"
He seemed surprised. "Most of the night, too. It's not like I could sleep with the noise she was making." She nodded toward Tilly.
"Noise?"
Dolph asked, looking at Viola.
"Mostly it was the screaming that kept me up," Esta told him.
She shrugged, willing away her own exhaustion.
"I thought I might as well help since I wasn't getting any sleep."
"She should have been sedated."
Dolph glared at Viola. Viola crossed her arms.
"She is now, if that makes you happy." "Immensely,"
he drawled. Then he turned back to Esta.
"How is she faring?"
"I don't have any idea. She's quiet now, though."
Viola stepped forward.
"She'll come through. Don't you worry none."
With an impatient glare, Dolph turned to Viola.
"I'll worry when I'm ready to and not a second before."
Then his tired expression seemed to soften as he leaned into his cane.
"We'll give her a bit more time. Keep her sedated this time," he told Viola sternly.
"She'd hate this," Viola said softly, her worried eyes locked on the pale girl in the bed.
"Hate it or not, it's necessary. Keeping her calm is the most we can do for her for now. Her affinity is still there, but it's been broken somehow. It'll be up to her to decide whether she's strong enough to go on without it."
"Of course she'll be strong enough,"
Viola told Dolph, her jaw set determinedly.
"She always was."
"I don't disagree. But surviving this will require a different sort of strength than she's had to draw on before. Time will tell."
Dolph turned to Esta.
"Come with me."
He didn't wait for her to follow. Just before Esta made it to the door, Viola grabbed her wrist. The girl's strange, violet eyes bored into her.
"Thank you for what you did for her,"
she said, her voice breaking.
"And for me."
"It was nothing,"
Esta told her. An easy enough truth. But Viola only squeezed her wrist more tightly.
"No one else came,"
she said simply, before she let Esta go. Esta slipped out of the room and found Nibs and Dolph waiting for her in the hall.
"Should I make the arrangements?"
Nibs was asking. Dolph shook his head.
"Not yet. There's a small chance she could still pull through. We'll give her some time."
Nibs frowned.
"She's a talented healer."
"I'm well aware of that,"
Dolph said as he led the way down to the staircase at the end of the narrow hall.
"But Tilly's always been stronger than most, and her magic isn't completely gone. She's been loyal to me, so we'll give her, and Viola, time before I decide."
"Decide what?" Esta couldn't help asking.
"I won't let her suffer,"
Dolph said shortly.
"And I can't allow her to become a liability."
A dark understanding rose in Esta.
"So you'll..."
"I'll do what needs to be done to protect those who depend upon me," Darrigan sent me a note today, as you said he would. He'll meet with me in 2 days' time. With both Viola and Tilly otherwise occupied, I'd like you to be around, in case I need your help with him.
Esta nodded. Anything else?
Yes, Dolph said, looking her over. Go get some sleep. You look like something dragged from the gutter.
A homecoming of sorts. Wallach's Theater. Hart looked at the bottle of night wine someone had left on his dressing room table and considered his options. Going to Dolph Saunders for protection would be bad enough as a last resort. It was worse to be forced into it. He picked up the bottle and tipped it side to side, watching the dark, viscous liquid coat the sides of the green glass. Removing the stopper, he took a sniff. Flowers and something sweet cut through with the bite of cheap wine. It smelled like an opium den and a saloon all mixed together, revolting and beguiling just the same. How bad could it be if it made him forget what he had to do? After pouring himself a glass, he sat staring at his reflection. He had his mother's chin, and his hair waved like hers, but he saw too much of his father looking back at him for his liking. His nerves were jangling as he slowly lifted the glass. The smell hit him. Sweet and floral and sickening, and all at once a memory rose from that time after he'd rescued his mother from Paul Kelly's brothel. She never could stay sober for long, and every time she went missing, he'd have to hunt through smoke-filled basements to find her and keep her from any more trouble. He would try not to look as he pulled her clothes around her and dragged her back home, but she'd only hate him in the morning anyway. For seeing her like that, and for taking her away from the only thing she'd let herself love other than his father. A natural boy. He put the glass down and resealed the bottle. In the mirror, his reflection stared back at him, doubtful. After he was done cataloging his faults and putting away his regrets, he reached for his pocket watch before he remembered it had been stolen. Not that he really cared if he was late. Hart hated everything about the world below Houston. Its rotten, trash-lined streets, the tumbled rows of tenements teeming with desperation and despair, even the air, which was permeated by the stench coming from the outhouses behind them. So he hated what he was about to do even more. He didn't have to go in, he thought, as he came to the Devil's Own boxing club. He should have stayed away months ago. Maybe none of this would have ever happened. Nothing was stopping him from turning around and going right back to where he belonged, to his uptown theater and his clean, airy set of rooms, to his porcelain tub and a bath of boiling hot water, to the life he'd built out of nothing. A life that could still be enough. But the fire said otherwise. He'd managed to get his mother sober enough to leave her at a new address, but how long would it be before Kelly and his boys found her again? And they would find her, because Hart had no intention of letting Paul Kelly anywhere near Jack. He couldn't imagine what Kelly wanted with the Order of Ortis Audia, but if he ever managed to get their power behind him, it wouldn't mean anything good for his kind, and especially not for Hart himself. Much as he hated admitting it, Dolph Saunders was the only way he saw to get around that possibility. After all, Dolph had a reputation for protecting outcasts from the wrath of other gang bosses downtown, including Kelly's own sister, Viola. Let them fight each other while Hart made his move. If Dolph was right about what the book contained, he'd be out of the city and safely on the other side of the brink before any of them realized what had happened. They would be stuck inside, unable to reach him, and he'd be free. He ignored the twinge of guilt he felt when he thought of the other mages who would still be trapped. But they're already trapped. If anything, he told himself, their lives might be better if the Order didn't have their book. When he gave the kid on the other side of the door his name, he was let through to a long, familiar hallway to the back of the building. The closer he got to the end of it, the stronger the scent of sweat and blood, and the more vivid the memories. He'd spent the year after his mother had abandoned him, and before he was forced into Paul Kelly's gang, hanging around the Devil's Own. Back then, Dolph had still been a lanky teenager. He'd seemed larger than life to 12-year-old Hart. Even with his limp, Dolph had commanded the respect of anyone who knew him in the Bowery, and of anyone who dared cross him. It was the kind of respect Hart himself craved, and Dolph had become something of an older brother, the mentor and protector his own father had never been. The boxing club had become a safe space for him, or at least it had been safer than the streets where he'd spent too many nights.
He'd learned to fight there, to protect himself in ways that had nothing to do with magic.
And he'd spent more nights than he could count, eating at Dolph and Lena's table in their rooms above the Bella Strega. After he'd gotten caught up in Kelly's gang, he'd stayed away from them both. It had been more than 3 years since Hart had even talked to Lena, but the ache of her loss hit him then, suddenly and far too late. She'd been only a handful of years older than him, but she'd mothered him in ways his own mother had never been able to. Still, even after he'd heard she lost a baby, Hart hadn't risked crossing Kelly or Dolph to visit her. But now that he was back, surrounded by memories he thought he'd put aside, he was overwhelmed by the thought of her being gone. Lena had been too stubborn and determined to do anything she didn't want to do, but Dolph should have never put her in a position to be harmed by the order. Lena had meant everything to Dolph, so Hart didn't have any illusions about how disposable he would be, and he didn't feel all that much remorse for what he planned to do in the end. The book would be his, and Dolph Saunders could go hang for all he cared. When he reached the main practice room, he found Dolph in the same place he'd seen him so many times before, perched on a low stool, his chin resting against his silver-tipped cane as he watched two of his boxers pummel each other in the ring above him. They were both bare-chested, their skin already slick with sweat, and their chests heaving with exertion. They couldn't have been more than 15 or 16, but already each sported the tattoo that marked them as Dolphs, a double Ouroboros that featured a skeletal snake intertwined with a living one. Life and death, Dolph had once told him, back when they'd still been friends. Survival was about balance. The threat of death could inspire you to carve out a life worth having. Once, Hart had been eager to take Dolph's mark, but Dolph had said that at 12 he was too young to make that decision. He'd considered it again when he'd wanted to get out of Kelly's gang. Dolph could have easily given him the secrets he needed to buy his freedom. He'd thought that trading one mark for another was something he could live with, and he'd come to the boxing club to do just that. But because he'd been early that day, Hart had seen what happened to those who crossed Dolph Saunders. He understood then what the mark was capable of, what Dolph was capable of. He would never forget it, the way the man, who was years older than Dolph, had cowered and begged for another chance, the cold look in Dolph's eyes as he rejected the pathetic appeals. Dolph had motioned for two of his boys to hold the man still, and then he'd simply touched him with the head of his cane. The second the silver Medusa touched the tattoo, the mark came to life. The two snakes began moving, and the man's skin rippled as the ink turned the color of blood. And then it did become blood. The man screamed like a banshee until the two boys dropped him, and he fell unconscious to the floor. By then, the air in the room had gone cold and energy crackled, but Dolph had barely seemed to notice. He'd given a curt nod, and the two boys had dragged the man away. Unconscious or dead, Hart couldn't tell. Hart had turned around and left that day, and he had vowed to never take another's brand again. He would do everything on his own, trust no one but himself, even if it meant never truly getting away from Kelly's reach. Except now he might have a way. Stealing the Ars Arcana from the Order, from Dolph, might be a crazy, impossible death wish of a way, but Hart was about desperate enough to take it.
"You're late,"
Dolph said with his usual brusqueness. He didn't bother to turn around.
"I don't like to be kept waiting."
"Last I checked, I'm not one of your lackeys."
"Not yet,"
Dolph said, finally glancing over his shoulder to pin Hart with his blue-eyed stare.
"Don't get ahead of yourself, old man."
Dolph didn't react to the nickname the way he usually did. Instead, he let out a tired breath and gave Hart an unreadable look.
"I'm glad you've come."
Suspicious, Hart crossed the room to where Dolph was sitting.
"I'm only here because that skirt of yours conned me into it."
It wasn't the truth, of course. but it was better if Dolph thought he still had the upper hand. One of the boys nailed the other with a right hook that sent blood splattering. A few drops landed on Hart's polished black boots, and it took everything he had not to wipe it away in disgust.
That's enough.